Wild Precious Life is brought to you in part by Content Bookstore. Located in the heart of historic Northfield, Minnesota, the Content Shop is bright, warm, and welcoming to readers of all ages, interests, and walks of life. Drop by or shop online at contentbookstore.com. And we're brought to you by the Ashland University Low-Res MFA, where our accomplished faculty help you find your voice and complete your degree at your own pace. Expand your writing practice and refine your craft within the supportive community of Ashland University's Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing. Learn more and enroll today at ashland.edu. Have you noticed how we put people in boxes? We categorize them. We have codes, sometimes written but often unwritten, that allow us to decide how or what a person stands for or is. The football player doesn't write love poetry. The student who's brilliant at AP Physics couldn't also be a cheerleader or a bowling instructor or work in a nursing home. We figure folks stay in their lane. Sometimes our categories can be useful. We may assume right about somebody's politics or their commitment to organic farming. But speaking with today's guest, I thought about how this categorization often makes us miss out. Writer Ben Percy writes comic books and science fiction novels, but he also writes love letters and admires feminist short stories and has written some of the most beautiful reflections on marriage and parenting that I've ever read. He dresses like a lumberjack, sounds like Wolverine, and he's passionate about funding for the arts and about his kids having more strong female role models to look up to in books and movies. Plus, he's wicked smart. I am so thankful for our conversation. Let me tell you more about Ben. Benjamin Percy is the author of 6 novels, 3 short story collections, and a book of essays. His fiction and nonfiction have been read on National Public Radio, performed at Symphony Space, and published by Esquire, GQ, The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, Tin House, and more. He writes comics for Marvel, DC, and Dynamite, and is known for his work on X-Force, Batman, Wolverine, Green Arrow, and more. He co-wrote the feature film Summering, which recently made its debut at the Sundance Film Festival. His audio series Wolverine, The Long Night, won the iHeartRadio Award for Best Scripted Podcast, and his honors include an NEA Fellowship, a Whiting Award, 2 Pushcart Prizes, and inclusion in the Best American Short Stories. Ben lives in Minnesota with his family. Ben Percy, welcome to Wild Precious Life.
Thank you for having me on.
I'm glad you're here. We frequently welcome creative folks to the show to talk about their most recent project, a book, a play, a film. However, since you and I met in July and scheduled this interview a few weeks ago, I feel like your most recent projects pile is ever-changing. You work in film and television and podcasts and comic books and novels, and that's just the stuff I know about. So rather than only singing your praises for any one of these items, I thought today's conversation could be about the biz, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, let's talk about all of it.
Yeah, let's take a look at the opportunities and costs of the writing life. So why don't we just start with your story? Was 10-year-old or 15-year-old Ben Percy always hell-bent on becoming a writer?
No, not at all. But I grew up a voracious reader. Almost every night when my family was not watching Star Trek The Next Generation or Kung Fu The Legend Continues, we were sprawled out in the living room reading together. And my mom was probably reading a historical novel, and my dad was probably reading a science fiction novel, and my sister was, you know, probably gobbling up a book on physics while I was reading a fantasy or horror novel, in all likelihood. And that's what I specialized in, was those mass market paperbacks with embossed titles. You know, if they had a skeleton or a dragon on the cover, all the better. And we used to make a pilgrimage a few times a year to Powell's Books.
Amazing store.
I moved around quite a bit as a kid. But one constant is that my grandparents were in Portland. So we'd go up and over the Cascade Mountains and we'd visit my grandparents, but we would also stop by Powell's. And Powell's is a holy site. You know, it takes up an entire city block in downtown Portland and is home to not thousands, millions of books. And I would build a dark tower of paperbacks whenever I visited to ration out over the months to come. And so I, you know, spent a lot of time in make-believe. I spent a lot of time living in other worlds. And growing up in a rural area, sometimes that was my, you know, sort of rabbit hole survival outlet. So living this imaginary life, I guess it was no surprise that I had an imaginary profession in my mind. I wanted to become Indiana Jones. I actually went on several archaeological digs in high school. I joined up as a high schooler with the University of Oregon to excavate a Paiute village in the Christmas Valley region of Oregon. I worked with the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry, scouting out rock art sites. I applied to college with the idea that I would pursue an anthropology major. And just eventually that dream sort of dissolved. You know, I realized that Indiana Jones was, you know, that promise of it was not true, despite the fact that I had a fedora and a bullwhip that I would snap Coke cans off of fence posts with. You know, I had kind of an existential crisis when I went to college. I realized that what I had been planning on doing, I wasn't actually going to be doing. And I thought about dropping out for a while. And there were a few different things contributing to that decision, but I kind of had an existential crisis. I retreated to the wilderness. I worked for Glacier National Park. And during this time, I was keeping a journal for the first time. When I had approached my college counselor, he was one of the professors who had failed me that first semester. I went to Brown. So I went from rural Oregon, a graduating class of 14 students, to the urban East Coast, Ivy League, and was not prepared. I wasn't prepared academically. I wasn't prepared emotionally. Total culture shock. Anyways, I was on academic probation my first semester, in part because I just signed up for all these ridiculous classes, like digital security, when I didn't even know how to code computers. And so that professor was my counselor. And when I asked him, like, what I should do, he's like, well, you know, some people just, they aren't cut out for college. So as I walked out of his office, he called out to me and he said, you know, it's really weird that you're doing so poorly because you wrote the best application essay I've ever read.
Wow.
And so he did a disservice to me by being a total jerk, but he also, that final comment of his, it stuck with me. And so I started thinking about writing and I started keeping that journal and I started writing snippets of fiction and poetry and songs and love letters. Poems, because there was somebody at Glacier National Park. I was the gardener there, which I know is a weird thing to be at a national park.
They have a gardener there?
The gardener at Many Glacier. And at that lodge, there was a waitress who I took a fancy to. And anyways, I was writing her all these love letters and such. And one day we were watching the sunset over the Rockies, and she was like, you should be a writer. And I was like, okay. And I eventually married her.
I love it.
And I was in creative writing classrooms thereafter, my first workshops, and just like there was no question in my mind. I was all in from that first semester, all in.
I should have opened with a confession, which is that I did not read comic books growing up, except for maybe one that I got in like a dusty box of cereal, like a Veronica and Archie comic, you know, that kind of thing. But I've heard you talk before about those spinner racks at the end of the grocery store aisle where you found your comic books. And I think there was also another rack nearby there. Girls could read comic books and can read comic books in 100%. But I don't feel like, you and I are about the same age. I don't feel like growing up, that was the spinner rack that I was directed to. You know, I was reading the Sweet Valley High. You know, I'm getting book number 1 and 7, and my girlfriend's going to get 8 and 4, and we're going to trade across and, like, you know, fold down the dirty pages of the V.C. Andrews books. You know, I'm sometimes alarmed to think about the things
I read that stuff too.
I mentioned this because we came up through these, you know, traditions, but when I got to college, I didn't know there were different kinds of writing. I thought books were books were books, kind of like you're describing. Never occurred to me that we weren't going to learn Tom Clancy at college. Did you learn to read like a writer before you were a writer? Like, I'm hearing the names of the folks you read. And I remember those were in the syllabus in my class and syllabi in the classes I took as well. But when did you make a shift between like reading like the reader you were and reading like the writer you became?
It was almost instantly when I stepped into that first creative writing classroom that I began to sort of engage strenuously with style and map out just paragraph by paragraph, sentence by sentence, the way in which scenes were rolling out, the way in which emotions were conveyed. My pages looked encased in barbed wire, everything that I read. And I was a notoriously slow reader as a result, because I would read a story, then I would reread it, then I would reread it again. I'd just be literally mapping out things on a macro and micro level. That was, you know, just a bit of engineering that entered my life as soon as I realized I wanted to figure out what was going on underneath the hood of all these stories to make them affect me emotionally.
I think I've heard you talk about that as sort of a left brain thinking exercise applied to an endeavor that we often think about as being right-brained, right? That I'm just going to sit down and whatever comes.
Kind of like being pragmatic and a dreamer at the same time. You know, like sometimes when I'm caught up in the flow of the story, I'm not thinking about that stuff. Maybe it's ingrained in me instinctually at this point, but it's certainly something that I think about when rereading and when editing. So in retrospect, or it's also another thing that I think about when pre-planning material. So I'm thinking about all those algorithms, I guess you could say, that inform the what sometimes feels like the dream of storytelling.
Yeah, how do you plan a story? If we were going to write a story right now, how would you do it?
So with short stories, I tend to be more impressionistic, allow myself to improvise. Because a short story, you know, is a few days of work to get the first draft out. And if I have to start over, no big deal. But a novel is years of work. So I've written four failed novels. I wrote four failed novels before publishing one. I think most writers say the same thing. And everybody's got stuff in the drawer that didn't work out. And so the first novel that I actually published was one that I had mapped out. And that was because, well, two things informed that decision. One, when I was in grad school, I realized I was having some trouble with something I feel like is one of my stronger points now, and that's plot. So I took a short story writer who I thought was excellent at plot, and that's Flannery O'Connor. And I read and I read and I read and I read her short stories over and over and over again so that I was emotionally detached from them. And then I would map them out paragraph by paragraph. I would make a blueprint and I would write a story based on that blueprint that bore no resemblance to the original. For example, if in paragraph one, character A is introduced via dialogue as jealous and spiteful, I would try to introduce in my first paragraph a character and reveal their inner weakness that would be central to the story via dialogue. Or if in the second paragraph, the setting implied the tone, the thematics of the story, like maybe she was describing a neighborhood that was ruined, I would describe, you know, something like a mountain lion or something that looked that implied revenge or grief or whatever. So I would just sort of figure out what the cues were that added up to the mechanics of plot. I did that on like three different stories and it just clicked. And I was like, I get it now. So anyways, I realized here I am, four novels deep. I failed on all of them. And I had to teach a novel writing course. This is at UW Stevens Point where I was teaching at the time.
They asked you to teach a novel writing course, but you hadn't published a novel yet?
Teach a novel writing course, but I haven't published a novel. I felt like a fraud. And so I did the same thing that I did in grad school. I was like, all right, I'm going to take all these novels I really admire, and I'm going to reread them and reread them and reread them. I'm going to map them all out. So I did that. And I taught the class on different types, forms of novels. I don't think it's any coincidence that that very same semester I sold my first novel, The Wilding, to Grey Wolf Press. And thereafter, I just feel like I have to have an outline out of superstition. It's sort of like Dumbo's magic feather. You know, Dumbo can fly.
Is that the one that makes him fly?
He thinks it does. He doesn't actually.
Oh, but it doesn't. That's right. That's right.
So the outlines sort of feel like that. And I'll usually start outlining, you know, a year to 2 years in advance of writing a novel. I also want to have, I don't refer to them as so much as blueprints as constellations, because I don't know everything that happens, but I know the brightest stars. And if you think about a constellation, right, and the brightest stars, there's the vacancy of space between them. And we fill in with our imagination how those stars become a scorpion in the sky or whatever, or a bowman. So in the same way, like I know, okay, this is going to be my midpoint reversal. This is going to be my rock bottom moment. This will be a climactic moment towards the end. Here's the moment that triggers the character's investment in the story, blah, blah, blah. I'll know those bright moments, but then it's no fun if you know everything. I want to give myself room to make some shit up along the way. So that's usually how I approach novels. You know, comics are very much the same and very different at the same time. By that, I mean, I have to outline, because you don't work for Marvel and not tell them what you're going to do.
I think a lot of writers really kind of buck up against the idea of constraints, right? You hear that, oh, I can't be bogged down. But I heard Shonda Rhimes of Shondaland fame talk once about what it was like to write for network television, where there were just some unsayable words. There were, you know, you couldn't say that you had some constraints, and you had time constraints. You had to have room for commercials. That sometimes those constraints actually forced her to be more creative than just having a wide open prairie in front of
you. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, Terrence Hayes, when he's talking about poetry, he talks about the difference between free verse poetry and form poetry being a villanelle or a sonnet or a sestina. He says the difference between free verse and form poetry is the difference between breakdancing in a straitjacket. And it's cool if you can breakdance, but it's badass if you can breakdance in a straitjacket. And comics writing or TV writing or film writing is breakdancing in a straitjacket. You have constraints in a screenplay. By page 15, you need to have the inciting incident. By page 25, you need to have the doorway moment that bridges the gap between act one and act two. And, you know, it can seem conforming, but the thing that I always tell literary writers, because they're the ones who get all grumpy about this in particular, you know, when I visit campuses or when I teach at festivals or residencies or whatever, they're always, oh, tut, tut, I shall not ever use a constraint. And I'm like, well, dudes, like, look at yourself. Like, you are essentially built of the same stuff. You know, the general arrangement of organs and bones are roughly the same between you and Cher and Tiger Woods and your mail carrier Susie or whatever else. It's like, and yet we're all so different, right? And you have these bones, in other words, these structural bones that, generally speaking, make up a story, whether it's a novel, whether it's a screenplay. Obviously, there are differences, but the differences are more subtle than people might expect. And if you know those standards, then you're free to break them as well, or to reinvent them. I mean, Picasso did not begin his life as an artist drawing cubist, painting cubist. You know, he started drawing realism, painting realism, and then made that leap. And it was only because he had those fundamentals in mind that he was able to be taken seriously as somebody who was groundbreaking.
Yeah, you got to learn the rules before you break them, they always say. I love to start sentences with and but I also have to remember the nun who told me not to do that.
Oh, yeah. I had some bad experiences with nuns, too.
Who hasn't? So then what was your big break? So we left you in a field with the girl you wanted to marry. And then there's a novel. Is the novel your big break? You were teaching novel writing before that. What, when you look back on the jump from guy who writes sentences that nobody reads but me to working writer, like what was a break in there?
So I started off, you know, publishing in journals. And does anybody read even the most famous of journals? I don't know. I'm not sure. But, you know, I worked my way up to places like the Paris Review. I worked my way up to glossy magazines like Esquire. I later became a contributing editor at Esquire and GQ and Time. And so everything was incremental, right? And in the same way, like, I published a book of short stories with a university press. That was my first book. Then I published a book of short stories with a small press, Grey Wolf. Then I published a novel with a small press, Grey Wolf. Then, you know, things started to heat up. Everything's incremental. And I got to a point where I had pitched a comic series to Vertigo. And it was Vertigo, if you don't know it, is like the HBO of comics. It doesn't exist anymore. I pitched this 30-issue comic series to Vertigo, and it was a horror series. And they're like, dude, this is cool, but you've never written a comic before. We're not going to hire you to write a 30-issue original series. But, you know, stay in touch. Anyways, my agent was like, this idea is really cool. What if we do it as a novel instead? So, you know, I reframed it. I wrote out about 70 pages of it. I included that outline and sold it for, you know, a considerable amount of money so that I was able to then take a step, you know, step back from teaching. And I enjoy teaching. It makes me feel like I'm earning my oxygen. But anyways, I was able to go full time at the keyboard. And I still teach in that, like, I'll teach at a writer's conference every now and then. And that makes me sort of feel like I'm tapped back in to whatever I've been missing. But yeah, Red Moon was my big break. And I don't just write novels. You know, the way that I make a living as a writer is I write comics, as you mentioned before. Or I write for TV. That's how I get my health insurance, or movies. And yeah, I'm a hustler.
I think I heard you say once that success, at least for you, has almost always risen out of failure. Do you still believe that?
Success has almost always come out of failure. Rejected from DC, rejected from Vertigo. There's sort of a bivalent success story there. And then I kept submitting. I think I submitted 47 pitches to DC. So from 2009, that's when I started. 2009 all the way to 2014. 2014 is when I finally got a yes. And that yes was for Detective Comics, was for Batman. So a super auspicious way to debut. But what people don't know is that I had failed all that time before. And what they also didn't know, and what DC did not know, is that Batman story that I wrote, which kicked off my career in comics, that Batman story was a failed Hollywood script. So I'd sent the script all over Hollywood, every studio had passed, and then DC was finally like, okay, stop bothering us so much, Ben Percy. We have a 2-issue opening for Batman. Like, what do you got? And I was like, And I took that screenplay, which I really loved and believed in. It was just like ridiculously expensive. It would have cost like $400 million to make. And I didn't think about like, oh, maybe, you know, my first screenplay should be something that costs somewhere in the neighborhood of $3 million to $5 million. It's like, oh no, here's this $500 million blockbuster.
We're going to blow up the Empire State Building and then we're going to crash. Exactly. Too expensive.
So, but comics, right? Your special effects budget is unlimited. So I took the idea, I pulled the main character out, I put Bruce Wayne in, and boom, sold it. And soon enough, I've got like a Green Arrow gig, writing Green Arrow for 52 issues. I've got Teen Titans, blah, blah, blah. The idea is that like, you're going to encounter wreckage in your career constantly if you're in the arts. Are you able to recognize the turn that can lead you to success that comes out of it?
So I hear your handling of failure seems to be repurposing, shifting, maybe this 40 book series is actually a novella, that you are believing in the material enough to keep sending it out there, perhaps in a different form.
Constantly. Nothing is wasted. I'm always finding repurposing things. And, you know, it's sort of like sheer cussedness too. Like if I have a superpower, it's like being cussed.
That's a Midwestern grandfather term if I've ever heard it. So those doubt arrows don't pierce your thick skull.
No, of course I've like got get really angry or I get sad. But then like I'm very, even though I am a dark-hearted guy and that I write really weird Stephen King-ish stuff, like I'm a very optimistic person. And that's just lucky for me to have that sort of brain chemistry. So I'm always thinking like, okay, there's a way to make this work. How do we do this? And so that has come in very handy in an industry that is really defined by failure, defined by the word no.
You've probably been told no more than you've been told yes.
My career is defined by the word no, but you got to have cussedness.
Yeah, people wouldn't probably know that looking at you, right? There's a pile of comic books and novels and other things next to your name, but for every one of those, there's 10, 20, 50 no's.
My name is Cindy Burnett, and each week I interview at least 2 traditionally published authors on my podcast, Thoughts from a Page. We talk spoiler-free about their books, so you can listen whether you have read the book or not. And then we delve into things that you most likely won't hear about anywhere else. The importance of the cover design, why they included various aspects of the story, personal details about both the books and the authors' lives, and so much more. You can find the podcast on every major platform and learn more about it on my website, thoughtsfromapage.com. Thanks so much for checking it out.
Hey, you also wrote something about that you've thrown away hundreds or even thousands of pages, and sometimes you need to throw pages away, and sometimes you need to keep them. How do you know which page is which? When to throw it away and when to keep it? Sounds like a line from The Gambler. When do I know? When do I hold it and when do I fold it?
I talk about The Gambler a lot. It's one of my favorite songs.
I love
like everything
song.
You need to know, everything you need to know about a career in creative writing is in that song. Especially if you're working across different mediums. And yeah, I mean, it's the thing is, it doesn't really matter if you throw something away, even if you think it's brilliant, because there's always more timber coming down the trail.
I love the idea. You call it a cemetery folder.
Yeah.
Ann Patchett has something like that when she writes too. What's a cemetery folder?
I don't really use this anymore, but it used to be a good practice for me because it allowed me to throw things away psychologically. So if I had a novel that I was working on, I would have a folder in that novel called The Cemetery. And in it, I would put all the things that I was cutting. And I'd organize them, you know, into different tombstones, I guess you could say, within the folder. You know, I'd organize them into documents like lost characters, descriptions of nature, blah, blah, dialogue scenes, blah, 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 whatever. And it just felt good to have like a place for it, because once you start saving multiple drafts, whatever was in draft, you know, 13 versus 30, like that stuff, you're not going to find it again. But having a place for it, like a compost heap, a cemetery, whatever you want to call it, is psychologically freeing. And, you know, sometimes when I would start a new project, I would go through the cemetery and sort of revisit some of those old pals and be like, you know, that was a pretty good, that was a pretty good description of a mountain. I'm going to use that. Plug it into the next book. But then, you know, it'd probably end up in the next cemetery as well.
I like that idea. It does give you permission to let go and be less precious about what it is you've written. Can we talk for a moment about Jaws?
Sure.
So I've attended lots of writer's talks. I'm kind of a junkie. I'm a sucker for listening to a creative person talk about how they create. But you are the first person who's ever convinced me that the key to plotting a successful novel might just lay in making a study of Jaws, the book that was later turned into a movie that terrified beach-going children like myself everywhere. Will you sell me on the merits of Jaws?
Yeah, I love that movie. I've seen it. When I say countless times, it's true. Like multiple times a year I watch it. And I just think it's brilliant. I think it's a perfect movie. I think it's a kind of a lousy book. That's one of the few cases where you can say like definitively the movie is worlds better than the novel. Think about the stakes of a character, right? The stakes of a situation. You have in Jaws the character of Chief Brody, played by Roy Scheider. He's our main character. I mean, in a way, it becomes an ensemble by the end that really focuses on these three dudes in the ocean. But if you think about him as the main character, you've got familial stakes, right? He is, in the novel and in the film, completely dedicated to his kids. And these categories sort of bleed together, but tied into that are the professional stakes and the financial stakes of the situation. He is new to Amity Island as the chief of police, and he is immediately in danger of losing his job and upsetting his family's life as a result. And potentially they're going to be bereft because of this. He's also, you know, familial sense, like terrified for his children, because on several occasions they're scared just about what's going on, but also in danger. There's that one scene where his boy is in the harbor sailing about, and while everybody else is distracted on the shore because somebody has been pulling a prank, you know, the person had like the fake shark's head attached to theirs, and they were snorkeling around, and everybody, you know, leapt out of the water and went crazy as a result. Like, no attention was paid to the harbor where his son was. Ugh. And the real shark went in there in the meantime and almost killed him.
I know.
So he's got familial stakes. He's also got marital stakes, romantic stakes, because in the book, his wife is actually having an affair. Yeah, his wife has an affair with the Richard Dreyfuss character, with Hooper, right? Which makes their time on the ocean even more tense. But with that, you know, those romantic stakes are sort of like gendered stakes. You know, if you think about it in sort of like traditional archetypes, this guy is trying to reclaim his masculinity by slaying a giant white penis. He's trying to best the others on the boat, you know, as well. And you know, there's political stakes. Like, here's this mayor who's like pressuring the chief of police hard. Like, we have to open these beaches because Amity Island, financial stakes, makes all of its money during the tourist season. If we can't have people going in the water, nobody's going to come. We're going to be broke. And I'm probably going to get booted from office. So anyways, you see all these different stakes. I've laid out like six of them already. And they all are sort of cycled through the story almost at 10-page intervals. You know, you'll focus on one thing, you'll focus on the next thing, you'll focus on the next thing, and it just cycles through them in an almost cylindrical way so that you're constantly anxious about one thing or the other until at the very end they all converge in this moment of climactic action.
Yeah, I've been seeing it a whole different way since I first heard you talk about Jaws and the notion that what you think is it's a book about a guy chasing a shark and you forget all the other crud that he had to deal with in order to even be on that boat, terrified, chasing that shark.
Yeah. I've been talking about midpoint reversals too. One other little nugget from Jaws, like midpoint reversal in a story is where your character has a plan and the plan doesn't work. The plan fails. And that's the midpoint reversal, is when the plan shifts. The midpoint reversal is almost always accompanied by a change in scenery as well. In Jaws, they're trying all these different things like shut down the beaches or send out people into the harbor, into the ocean to hunt the shark. And let's bait the shark. Let's toss dynamite in the water. Let's post lifeguards. Let's none of it works, right? So what has to happen? Chief Brody, who critically is afraid of water, so he has to face his worst weakness, has to go out on the ship with Richard Dreyfuss, Hooper, and with Robert Shaw, plays Captain Quint, right? There's that change in scenery that accompanies the exact center point of the film.
Yeah. No, I can't get Jaws and these shifts out of my head for how a story is shaped. It's been blowing my mind ever since then.
Everything you need to know about fiction is in Jaws.
So I've been in I've lived a lot of places, so I've been in a number of book clubs. And I will say, suburban women do not read enough sci-fi. I'm just going to say that. Ladies, I don't think we're doing our part. There's plenty of women who read them, but the book clubs I've been in, we're not reading enough sci-fi. And I'm just going to put this out there that I came to the Comet Cycle books, this trilogy that I think could be, as I've heard you talk about, could be dozens of books. But I bought them as an early Christmas present for my husband. I bought the first two. And then I ended up reading them myself. And there was certainly science and meteors and mysteries, but I think what I love most about your sci-fi novels is the humanity. I expected monsters, and sure, they're there, but you're writing about the trials and tribulations of parents and children and people striking out on their own to make their way in the world. And it was just so beautifully, recognizably human to me. Not to diss other genre writers, but do you think that sometimes they forget that alien outer space robot monster books also need to be human?
At the end of the day, if there's not a human heart beating at the center of your story, nobody's going to care. So it has to be sort of like character first. No matter how high concept your idea, it has to be character first.
Yeah. I mean, in The Unfamiliar Garden, there really are mushrooms from outer space. But what I'm attracted to is the fact that you wrote something beautiful about what it was like for Nora and Jack to rely on one another in the early days of raising a child. And that, oh, gorgeous.
About the thing and the other thing, right? That's the really simple way to put it. But yes, you've got, you know, alien fungus. Great. But, you know, here's a story that's broken down, sort of like Fates and Furies, if you know the Lauren Groff novel, where it's like a him, her story. So it's in his perspective, it's in her perspective. It's in his perspective, it's in her perspective. They're divided. They're divided, we learn, because they lost their child. On the night that the meteor shower happened, they lost their kid. And they're already having some difficulties, and that cleavage between them just broke them wide apart. But now, right, he is a university professor, he's a biologist, he's a mycologist, and there's a new fungus that's popping up that he's researching. And then here you have his ex-wife, Nora, and she's a police detective in Seattle, and she's investigating a series of murders. And they're going to be brought together first professionally, and then emotionally again. And then there's the possibility that arises that their daughter is actually still alive. And all these things result in, by the end of the novel, a convergence of point of view where it's no longer he said, she said, but it's they. The end of the book is a they. It's a collective perspective. And as a result of that, that union, I wanted to have, you know, as a sort of thematic backdrop to fungus itself, which is a symbiotic organism.
Yeah, it's bananas how good you are at this, man. These were supposed to be Christmas presents for my husband, but I started flipping through. I'm like, well, let me just sit down with this. And then before I know it, I've read the whole book. So, you know, husband, I'm still going to wrap it and give it to you, but it's just, the pages are riffled.
Too bad for you, husband.
Oh, I could talk books with you all day, but I'm going to wrap because we always do a few things at the end here. So I like to end with icebreakers. Think of this as like, I don't know, seventh grade camp. So this first part is just multiple choice. Just pick one, okay? Dogs or cats?
Dogs.
Coffee or tea?
Coffee.
Mountains or beach?
That's tough, but mountains.
Batman or Wolverine?
Wolverine. But Batman's still awesome.
Lord of the Rings or Big Trouble in Little China?
Oh, you're killing me. I mean, I can extensively quote both. I guess I'll go LOTR just because it's a more expansive universe.
I'll give you that. You were one of the first people I've ever seen to write about Big Trouble in Little China, which was played a formative part in my younger years. Just that whole watching stuff you probably shouldn't have.
Old Jack Burton of Pork Chop Express. Coming to you on a dark and stormy night.
I love it. Okay. Let's see. Are you an early bird or a night owl?
Neither. I wake up at 7. I go to bed at 11.
Just a regular person in the middle there.
Right in the middle.
This is a bit of an onomatopoeia question. Which do you favor more, the word growl or the word squelch?
I guess I'm naturally inclined to growl.
Although I do like to hear you say the word squelch.
Squelch.
That word works for me it works in a number of, just when you're looking for a word, just squelch. I don't have a low enough voice. You do.
Squelch.
Are you a risk taker or the person who always knows where the Band-Aids are?
Risk taker. Pragmatic risk taker. I mean, you can't be a writer, full-time writer, and not be a risk taker.
This is a fill in the blank now here. If I wasn't working as a writer, I would be a...
Pixar villain?
The voice of or actually live in the cartoons of?
Both, method acting.
Yeah, I would have put you on a stage. I still would, but that's where I would... When I listen to the Wolverine podcast...
I'm coming for you, Buzz and Woody.
When I listened to the Wolverine podcasts for just a moment before I heard credits, I wondered if you would be in there somewhere. I was listening for your voice.
About giving me a few cameos, but then they thought, you sound too weird. People would be like, what the hell was that? I can't just be like a guy at a bar. You sound like a monster.
I'll still keep listening for you. All right, this is another fill in the blank. What is something quirky that people don't know about you? A like, a love... A pet peeve. Your imagination's all on the page. So I'm trying to think what we would know about you, the guy.
Yeah, I'm unloading a constant. I don't know what you wouldn't know. I'm a pretty boring person. I just work.
Well, that in itself is actually kind of interesting.
Here's something weird. I mean, people would know this if they've actually read my backstory, but like one of the tallest trees in North America is located just outside of Eugene, Oregon. And for an assignment, I climbed to the very top of it. I had a crossbow up to the first branch, which was several hundred feet up. And then I climbed it with a guide accompanying me. And then I spent the night in the tree in a hammock. So 250 feet.
What?
And
Why did you do that?
For an article.
I don't think I read that one in my research. I'm going to look for that one.
Wall Street Journal. Yeah.
Was it terrifying? Did you sleep at all?
I'm not afraid of heights at all. I mean, I slept at 250 feet, so it's... You know, you look over the hammock, it's a long way down. At one point, I woke up in the middle of the night, and there was just an owl staring at me on the branch.
That's bananas.
No mosquitoes at 250 feet.
I guess not. Hey, what do you love about where you live?
Minnesota is green. I mean, when I say that, I'm saying you look at a map, and there's a lot of public land. As opposed to when I was living in Iowa, it's almost all private land. So there's a lot of public land. There's a lot of forest to explore. It's also an interesting sort of ecotone, meaning there's three different ecosystems that converge here. You know, you've got the deciduous forest, you've got boreal forest, and then you've got plains. The northern section is the most interesting to me, probably because I grew up in Oregon and prefer evergreen forests. But that's also where Lake Superior is, which is an inland sea. You know, it's the greatest freshwater source in the world. And so I love all those things when it comes to the natural geography about the place. I'm also a winter guy, and there's no better winter than Minnesota's. But it also is just like a very progressive state that also believes in artists. And it has the number one arts funding of any state, I believe. It's second only to New York for publishing. We have Grey Wolf, Milkweed, Rain Taxi, Coffee House Press. We have the Loft Literary Center, dozens of indie bookstores. There's great theaters. There's great music venues. So it's like, it's a pretty awesome place to live, actually.
That is one of the best answers I've ever heard for Minnesota. I've only talked to one other Minnesotan, but she's probably my other great... That- You guys should be on billboards, and there's a whole campaign, I think, for Minnesota.
No, Minnesota tourism. We don't want them
anymore. I was about to say, though, because that was my next thing, is I don't think Minnesota wants us to know it's there.
Bunch of damn Californians moving out here, trying to steal our water.
You guys have enough of it. Share. What are some of your favorite books?
Well, this is a question that could go on forever, too. But, you know, I'm... kind of obsessed with Cormac McCarthy. Very excited about his two new books launching this fall. You know, The Road, it's probably the scariest novel I've ever read. Maybe because I read it for the first time anyway, right after my son was born, and it just hit a nerve.
It sits different when you're a parent, that's for sure. That book sure does.
Yeah, it truly like physically affected me reading it. And I love Shirley Jackson. She's one of my high priestesses. What she does for the horror genre, you know, is imbue it with that literary sensibility, like that deep characterization and that filigreed language. I love writers like Neil Gaiman and Octavia Butler and Ursula K. Le Guin for the way in which they write about fantasy and sort of transgressive fantasy. And also just their literary technique is, you know, something to feel marvel over. You know, you could pluck any sentence out of any one of their stories and frame it and hang it on the wall and invite your neighbors over and say, like, look at that sentence. And they'd say, damn. So those are just a few. Those are just a few writers who I think are amazing.
How about some favorite movies?
Again, like, I could just keep going, but Rocky, obviously, for spiritual reasons, Jaws, Godfather, John Carpenter's The Thing. I mean, you mentioned Big Trouble in Little China earlier. John Carpenter is kind of one of my heroes. Recent movies, I'm big into the art house horror coming out right now, including Midsommar and Hereditary, Get Out and such. Horror movies are probably where I'm always going to lean first, but I love crime movies as well, like No Country for Old Men. So another Cormac McCarthy.
Yeah, there's a theme here. All right, last two. Favorite ice cream?
I don't like dessert.
What? That's an excellent answer.
I'm a weirdo. I would take meat over any kind of dessert.
So I'm going to just write down meat for that answer. Favorite meat. Ice cream, I'm going to write down meat.
Meat.
I love that so much. All right, last one. If we were to take a picture of you really happy and doing something you love, what would we see?
Oh, I'd probably be hanging out on the north shore of Lake Superior with my family. Staring out at the water, going on a hike, something like that. Or I'd be seated, you know, in the center seat, middle row of a movie theater with my family and a big bucket of popcorn and an icy Coke.
I've been missing movies lately to get back there. Okay, that's excellent. Ben Percy, thank you for joining us today. You've said that storytellers should give into whimsy and that writing is an act of empathy. Thank you for bringing so much of your wisdom and whimsy here today and for giving us some empathy that in the world of starving artists peddling our books from the trunks of our cars, there is in fact a writing life out there, a career a person can pursue. For folks listening, you can pick up Ben Percy's novels, including The Ninth Metal, The Unfamiliar Garden. Those are the first two books in his Comet series. When's the third coming out?
I'm doing the edits right now, so it should be 9 months-ish.
9 months, man. All right. Well, get the first two at an indie store near you, and there's lots, actually. The Dark Net, and there are many others. Aspiring writers, you can grab his craft book, Thrill Me, Comic Book Readers, You can grab the X-Men and, I mean, everything. Film watchers, podcast listeners, whatever your medium. Wolverine, type Benjamin Percy into the search bar and you will be regaled. To everyone listening, we're wishing you love and light wherever this day takes you. Be good to yourself. Be good to one another, and we'll see you again soon on this wild and precious journey.
Wild Precious Life is a production of Evergreen Podcasts. Special thanks to executive producers Gerardo Orlando and Michael D'Aloia. Producer Sarah Wilgroup. And audio engineer Ian Douglas. Be sure to subscribe and follow us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to Novel Conversations, a podcast about the world's greatest stories. I'm your host, Frank Lavallo, and for each episode of Novel Conversations, I talk to two readers about one book, and together, we summarize the story for you. We introduce you to the characters, we tell you what happens to them, and we read from the book along the way. So if you love hearing a good story, you're in the right place. Our ninth season is coming this fall. Tune in to hear from some of the all-time great authors, Charles Dickens, Jules Verne, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and more. Subscribe to Novel Conversations wherever you listen to podcasts.